Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
I'm joined today by Mariano, co-founder and CEO of Student Finance, and really excited to have you here today. I'm going to pass over straight to you, Mariano, and could you briefly introduce yourself and Student Finance for our audience?
Yeah, my name is Mariano Kostlik. I'm the founder and CEO of Student Finance. So quickly, my background. So I'm, I guess, an international person. I lived in 10 or 11 countries, studied in the UK, worked in Asia, co-founded a previous company, which is a housing platform operating across Europe. And now, more recently, a few years ago, I co-founded Student Finance to solve the problem of upskilling and reskilling the global workforce.
Awesome, great. And yeah, I'd love to dive a bit more into that background. So I imagine maybe it's quite connected. And, you know, in your background, how it led to the founding of Student Finance?
Before starting Student Finance, I was working on my previous company called UniPlaces. And UniPlaces is a housing platform where on one side, you had a lot of young professionals and students. On the student side, the affordability topic was always there. This was always a pain point for people to afford, obviously, in that case, accommodation and housing, but also more broadly speaking, education cost. So that was half of the story that came there. But what actually was the trigger to let us to actually say, hey, let's actually then solve this problem was when we started to really see the other side of the equation, which is the gap or the lack of talent or skills in a lot of sectors. We were facing it in particularly in the tech and, you know, tech area, obviously from, you know, looking at bringing on board engineering talent, etc., and looking how lots of companies out there across Europe, in the US, pretty much globally are facing those same challenges. The stories around the skills gap and the lack of talent for specific sectors has been growing and growing in the past years. And, you know, that's when I was transitioning off the day-to-day of running UniPlaces. I moved to a non-exec function at the time, and I was, excited to start something new. And that's when I worked. Basically, I joined with Marta, who is my co-founder, and we decided to solve this. So essentially, we brought together those two problems, which is the need to actually upskill or reskill a large share of the global workforce. Obviously, I mentioned specific tech and different sectors, but when you look at this more broadly, you know, there's a constant shift in the economy, in the world. The type of skills that people need are constantly developing and changing, and that creates shortages of certain skills in the market, which are obviously being accelerated massively by transition and change in technology and so on. So yeah, we decided to solve something. And, you know, obviously looking very, you know, broadly about that, there's several problems that we've been looking at. One is actually how do you solve affordability, just to start with the previous point. So a lot of the reason why people don't get trained and upskill into the sectors that are in actual demand is because of sometimes the cost of this, right? So these programs are not necessarily cheap, or even if they're cheap, you know, which cheap or expensive is always relative to a person's situation, right? So there's always a financial barrier. So let's put it like that. And that was the first thing. And we can talk more about how we're addressing that. But we are seeing the two other key parts of this problem, which is one is the data, how you actually make sure that people can really know what career move they should take, like what is the right change for them? Because, you know, in general, there might be need for specific skills in the market, but how do you know what is the right thing for you, right? So that requires a lot of understanding, a lot of data insights, you know, and a lot of personalization to really understand how your background, your situation, your sets of skills, etc., and your motivation and interest, how you should use that and, you know, decide what to do next, right? And that is one thing that stops a lot of people from actually taking action, knowing where they should go, right? So we're doing a lot of data work to, you know, enable people to understand the demand for specific skills, you know, to be able to predict, you know, demand and even things like income, salary levels, etc., into the future, right? So that's one piece. And the other part that is also very relevant when you talk about, okay, the skills issues and talent gap, etc., is actually matching the different stakeholders, right? So, and here you have obviously people that need upskilling and they want to progress professionally, et cetera. You have education providers of different shapes and forms, right? That provide those skills and actually can teach people for those areas. And then employers, companies that need the talent, right? And those are three different sets of stakeholders. And there needs to be efficiency in how you connect those effectively, right? So the way we see student finance is essentially a career mobility platform now to address those three challenges and enable people to upskill to the areas in high demand by removing those, you know, three barriers that we've been identifying that are the main blockers from these to happen.
So how does the platform work in practice? So let's say I'm looking to enroll in like a coding bootcamp. I can't finance it myself. I arrive at Student Finance's website. Like what happens next?
Yeah. So there is two ways to look at that. Obviously, on one side, we partner with a lot of education programs. You mentioned coding bootcamps. So actually quite a few of our partners are in that category. So tech and digital courses, you know, very focused on those skills, you know, short in duration, typically 3 to 6 months. Some of them are actually longer. But how would you do it in practice? One, you could go either directly to some of those partner schools. And so we as a company first, we do, you know, we partner with these programs, we prevet them, we look at their quality, their performance, we look at how they, you know, their admissions processes, their teaching quality, how they help people actually get a job and, you know, succeed in the labor market. So we analyze all of that. Actually, you know, we run essentially a scoring process on each partner that we have. And we agree on obviously supporting them, and we integrate our platform to their own admissions processes and systems. So if you go directly to one of these education providers, they would give you the option to typically pay when you get a job, or, you know, different flexible payment options. A lot of these use cases is about reskilling, right? Someone changing career. And in that category, enabling them to actually pay when they get a job and when they have income above a certain threshold, it's key because it's a big life transformation these people are going through, right? So you would go to the course, you would apply, you'd pass the admissions criteria, you would then apply through the platform that is delivered from the education providers to our, you know, let's call it financing option there. And then once you get approved, obviously you will be able to enroll there, deliver the course, and then start making payments. And now we said how exactly it works. So when we, you know, the first or the main product that we launch, and it's still our main, is what we call an income share agreement structure, which means from a payment perspective, instead of paying upfront, you pay, as I said before, when you earn above a specific income threshold, and you would be paying a percentage of that monthly earning until reaching a maximum number of payments or a total maximum amount. And this is interesting because it gives the people a huge, you know, let's call it downside protection, in a sense that until they have sufficient income, or even if they lose that income in the future, their payments are put on hold until they secure a new job. When you talk about, obviously, what are we doing as a business here? So because our incentives are completely aligned to ensure you have a job, you succeed professionally, economically, et cetera, we are there to support you, right? So essentially, Student Finance is a partner that is enabling not only to access education and access those training programs, but also get a job after that. So we are investing also in, you know, when I said before about matching the different stakeholders, is also about enabling access to the job market. So connecting to employers, you know, using our infrastructure to help people transition to the labor market and secure a job after they completed those courses, right? So this is all part of the proposition there. And it's all about ensure we can, you see, upskill to that new job or a new area that they're going to.
Got it. Makes sense. And so the role of the education providers themselves, and so obviously they're happy that they're having people enroll who might not usually have been able to and have easier access to finance. But does your partnership with them kind of go beyond that? It sounds like you're vetting them. But yeah, we'd love to understand a bit more about their role.
Yeah. So obviously we integrate as, let's say, deeply as possible into the education providers, you know, so we enable them to onboard people that, you know, want payment flexibility. But even beyond that, even from this perspective, offering these type of payment options, just the fact that an education provider offers an option of paying when you get a job shows it's a quality standard. It's a conviction that they believe this will actually lead to a successful outcome for that person, right? Now, I did mention about when we qualify private education providers, we also structured economic incentives so that the actual education provider has, let's call it, skin in the game in the success of their own students or their own users, right? So they only get the full payment for the course when the person actually secures a job and starts repaying, right? So they have those same incentives. And I think that is a very important piece here that actually ensures that everyone has the same focus on, you know, upskilling, reskilling. And when you look at upskilling and reskilling, this is not about giving people skills. You know, the whole purpose of reskilling is being very much conscious of what the job market needs, the very granular details, and ensure people actually, you know, secure that job or progress economically, et cetera, right? And that's why we're making it so that it all aligns to that. Obviously, the core function or job of the education provider is to provide those skills and provide quality of teaching, quality of training, but really focus on that job market needs. And I think that is one of the things that we fundamentally believe in, is that you see the job market is evolving massively. People need to get continuously reskilled and upskilled, you know, and this will continue on an ongoing basis. But when we talk about reskilling, it's all about those skills, right? And I think it's important to understand what employers look for, and, you know, making sure that the courses and the training options provide that. Often a lot of these courses or education providers are, you know, specific, you know, either certification or a specific course in a specific subject, but very much focus on that. And if you look at, I think how we look at this is that people will continuously need to, you know, upskill, reskill continuously or multiple times throughout their professional careers. And this is always an ongoing part of how they should look at it. And obviously education providers are a key piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like kind of all sides are very well aligned. And yeah, there's good kind of, you know, having that skin in the game for the education providers means that, you know, everyone's kind of interests are all in the right places. So what are your thoughts on some more traditional education providers, you know, traditional universities, et cetera? Like, seems like you're partnering with more as the kind of specific kind of skill sets and boot camps and things like that. Where does traditional universities come into this? Do you think they maybe have some inefficiencies and misalignment with the job market? And could you ever partner with them? Would you even want to? And yeah, we'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And, you know, obviously traditional education from a higher education perspective, so talking specifically about universities, you look at undergrad and postgrad, I think if you look at master's degrees, they're often closer to job markets, right? And they're also shorter, they're typically 1 year, sometimes two. So from that perspective, I think you do see a lot of master's or, you know, these kind of specialization courses that are very much, you know, focused on job market demand. And you could obviously look at supporting these type of institutions. We do have actually a number of, let's say, master programs that we work with as well. Now, I think what's interesting, we look at undergrad, these tend to be 3 or 4 year courses and programs. And I think there obviously depends on the market. You see, for example, in the US, that is getting extremely expensive. People take huge amount of student debt to go to undergrad courses or to university in general. In Europe, depends on the country, you know, and depends on the university. There is obviously different price points for all of that. I think the question there is also the transparency of what is, you know, why should people attend those particular programs, let's say, right? If someone, for example, just wants to get a job somewhere, maybe that's not necessarily the right path for them. Or even if it is, for example, if the course is very extensive, they need to know, okay, what kind of job outcomes that will potentially lead them to, what kind of income they will be making from those jobs, and then make their own decision whether the ROI of that course or that undergrad program works for them, right? So sometimes also there is a lot of very, you know, prestigious universities in the US, Ivy Leagues and others, obviously in Europe, etc. Those will always be there. They might cost a lot or not, but, you know, people go there because of reputation, because of prestige and other factors. So I think those will be always there. Now, 80% or 90% of people do not go to that kind of institutions. They go to a, they get education because they want to get a job. They want to, you know, be able to have an income, etc. And if you look at it from that perspective, I think it's important that we really provide, and that's what I said, part of the, you know, what we as student finance were working on is producing the data layer of providing insights to people as to, okay, this particular course will lead to these kind of job outcomes. This is the amount of demand in the job market for these particular skills. This is the type of, let's say, salaries that you could expect to earn if you go to the, if you have these skills with this course and you get a job. And, you know, being transparent about all of that, including the demand for specific sectors, right? Because the job market continuously fluctuates, right? And you need to be able to project into the future how these fluctuations will keep developing. You see today, look, everyone talks about artificial intelligence. What does it mean for education? What does it mean for the job market? So it will change a lot of things in all of these areas. The job market will change massively. It's clear that some jobs will be disappearing or parts of them will go away. And a lot of others will emerge, right? So people will need to shift how they work because obviously tasks, if you look at artificial intelligence, or if you look at tasks that machines can produce better than humans, why would you want humans to be doing those tasks, right? So obviously it's better to have a machine to do them, right? Now, that also means, you know, it's interesting. You see today, the expectations on the job market are changing a lot. Before, for example, someone would require, I don't know, 10 hours to do something. Now you can do the same thing in 1 hour just because you can amplify your capacity using artificial intelligence tools. And if you just look at these kind of things, that means, okay, jobs, skills, what's required is continuously changing. And people need to understand, okay, regardless if you go to a traditional university or a very specific skills-based course at any point in their career, the more understanding you have of what this means after that, the better, right? And from our perspective, that's how we look at it. We know that people used to talk about things like lifelong learning. So when you say traditional university, this is typically what you do when you're 18, 19, 20, but you work until you're typically 60, 65, 70. I don't know. It depends on the country when people are retired, etc. Mm-hmm. So it's like these 40 plus years where the pace of change is just exponentially increasing. And that means, you know, it's not about you do a university course once and then never again. You might do it or you might not do it, but in, regardless of that, you will need to keep upskilling or reskilling continuously or multiple times throughout your professional career, right? And that's the role we are playing. And if you look at, you know, just on a macro level, the World Economic Forum said a statistic that over 1 billion people we need to be reskilled this decade, right? And this is a huge amount of people, right? This means pretty much close to half of the working population. And it sounds like a lot, but actually, if you look back 10, 15 years, a lot of jobs that exist today that people do did not exist back then. And now we take them as for granted, and like things like digital marketing, you know, SEO optimization didn't exist before Google launched the search engine, content creators and TikTok, etc. These are all jobs, functions, people actually earn money on all of these things. You know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, people would not even imagine these things could exist or be a job. And if you project this, you know, 5, 10, 15 years into the future, we should expect probably even bigger shift because the pace of change is only accelerating. And the good news is exactly that, that the more you have data, understanding, and, you know, platforms to enable you to upskill or reskill to those sectors, you can always stay ahead and actually have, you know, everything that you need to succeed in that environment.
Yes, definitely. So yeah, definitely sounds like you're in a great place to, you know, take advantage of some of those opportunities that are coming up in as the labor market kind of changes. But yeah, I'd like to take a step back. So I always find this part really, really interesting is what were those early days like? You know, maybe you had these ideas or hypotheses. How did that go from kind of an idea to the early businesses? Maybe as you're not like a first-time founder, maybe some of the earlier mistakes you didn't make. But yeah, I'd love to hear about those very, very early stages and how everything got going.
Yeah. When we started student finance, obviously we started with the hypothesis that, you know, there was a, okay, well, the shortage of talent. I think we felt it, we faced it, we've seen it. We look at the hypothesis whether this type of, you know, outcome-based financing products would be needed or, you know, in demand. So we went out and spoke to quite a good number of education providers, a lot of that tech bootcamps, and we asked them, what are the challenges? What are the problems they're facing? What is stopping them from actually growing, from onboarding people, from expanding their businesses? And yeah, they validated the need, obviously, for more and better financing products and, you know, very outcomes-driven approaches. What we did at the time, and I think it's going to be interesting for people that are looking, okay, how you get started. We actually, you know, I don't remember how many it was, but they 6 or 7 of those education providers, we asked them to sign literally like a letter of intent saying that if we actually build a solution like that, would they want to use it and would they pay for that? And we got 5 or 6 letters saying, yes, we will pay for that. We want these. And this was obviously good for validation. So we would start and working on that, but also was the first trigger. You know, we did raise some funding as a business. You know, when we start to speak to investors, we say, hey, but look, all of these clients signed letters saying that they want to work or they need this kind of service. And this was an important thing, especially because the type of product that we're building, it was essentially a financial product, right? So you need capital to actually launch it, right? And from that perspective, you know, having those very initial agreements in place and that market validation was, you know, very critical point to actually, you know, go from having nothing to make the first steps to actually start building the business and, you know, getting then, you know, the team around, investors on board, you know, and actually things starting to move and develop.
Great. And yeah, let's fast forward to now. So you were able to raise a huge, I think it was 39 million euro round back in February. So congratulations, first of all, for that.
Thank you.
I would also love to hear a bit more about that process, you know, particularly in this economic climate, which is, you know, pretty difficult and, you know, in a bit of a downturn, you know, the access to capital is maybe not what it was a year and a half ago. So yeah, I'd love to understand a bit more about that process and how everything went.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And of course, I have to say we're obviously fortunate to be able to raise the capital to, you know, to support our mission, you know, which, to be honest, we believe the need for this is only increasing and accelerating. I think investors have seen that and they see that the need to upskill and reskill is only increasing, right? And you need innovative and good solutions for that. Was this easy? Was it a simple process? Of course not. You know, if I would say that, I'd probably be lying. So the market has changed significantly, actually, throughout, you know, last year, you know, and still we're going through that phase now. So we were raising that in that period. A lot of funds that we were speaking with, you know, they literally pulled off from investing at all during that time frame, right? So you were speaking to people who said, we only support our portfolio companies and no one else, because also no one knew, especially investors, what was going to happen, and, you know, became a lot more conservative. At the same time, you know, because our business model is capital intensive, you need capital to grow. This is also something not every investor understands or is comfortable with. So another large category of investors, you know, obviously they would not be going to be involved in these kind of things because it's beyond their, you know, understanding and beyond actually their comfort zone, let's say. Having said all of this, obviously we're very fortunate to find very great partners who came on board. Iberish Capital is actually a fund that, you know, we knew from before through Portuguese networks. Actually, some, you know, our Mark Wake Fund is based in Portugal. A lot of our team is there. Two of our other investors are based there. So we had, you know, good connection with them and they really believed in what we are building here. The complexity on the fundraise also, this was an equity and debt transaction. The debt component came from a different fund, from an asset manager. Talking about how we got about that, obviously we spoke to different partners or different potential partners. We had several of them interested. This particular one was actually referred by one of our angel investors who is the founder of another leading, let's say, successful fintech business. And, you know, she recommended them and obviously they like a lot what we're doing and, you know, we like meeting them. I think that referral was a very important one, both obviously from both sides. So when you go to new investors that you don't know about, that you didn't speak before sometimes, it's hard to really know. So those referrals are very important. Now, having said all of these, and in the obviously context of the market situation, what we did see also is that comparing to previous fundraisers that we've done, either for student finance, this was the first round of capital we raised. The level of due diligence was probably more extensive than we could have previously expected. So this meant the closing of the round took longer. The fact was equity and debt has multiple components moving. So this was more complex than traditional or typical Series A, which is just maybe one or two lead investors and a few angels coming on board and you just close it. Here we had an equity piece and a debt piece coming together, which are very different. And, you know, the legal contracts were more complex and the diligence was more long. So that's obviously to give you a perspective of the process. But I think that the key was that, yeah, everyone's been super supportive and super engaged throughout the whole cycle. Now, obviously, we're fortunate to have closed this and, you know, we're excited about, you know, being able to have the capital and resources to make a big impact in the next phase, which is obviously something, you know, important. I think another part to add here, I think, is that we've all seen is that, the VC market has evolved a lot and now the expectation is a lot more about, you know, how can you really reach a sustainable business, ideally profitable, in a reasonable, you know, short time frame, which is actually good from a perspective that a lot of, you know, in the previous phase where maybe money was cheap and easier to get, it created a lot of businesses that didn't really have strong fundamentals or, you know, they were not really needed, or the economics didn't really work. And I think this is cleaning up a little bit of that and really focusing back on the basics. What is actually needed? You know, what do people really need? What society needs? What are business models that actually can be sustainable? And that means the companies that will emerge from these will be a lot stronger and, you know, a lot better than actually those that, you know, would have existed if the market had not changed as it has.
And I saw that your pitch deck was actually featured in TechCrunch, and we did like a little evaluation piece. How important do you think the pitch deck is to kind of going out there and telling your story?
Yeah, look, the pitch deck is obviously one important piece of raising funding, but it's not about the pitch deck. Obviously, it goes what goes into that, but also the relationship you're building with investors, the trust you're building. Obviously, you need to bring people to really buy into the vision, but they need to also see and believe that you can execute on that vision. And I think that's where, when you look at the pitch deck, it's also about showing, you know, especially to investors you have not previously had good or a lot of interaction, they need to know what you've done, you know, really believe that you can continue that. So showing the track record, showing, and even be open to, you know, sometimes not everything goes perfect, right? So you pivot, you change, showing that when you overcome an obstacle, you change and you adapt and you move on. I think all of these are important pieces of that. You know, the pitch deck on itself is an important piece that, you know, you need to make it easy for investors to want to invest in your business, right? And, you know, it's important to put some thoughts on that. Try to anticipate the questions they will have and answer them directly in the deck. There's a lot of materials and best practices out there of how to structure decks. So I don't think we need to go into that level of detail now. But I do think it's an important part. Now, probably, and I would say even more important than the pitch deck on its own, is actually building a relationship with investors and potential investors, you know, ideally way ahead of when you're actually looking to fundraise. And why is that? When you're actually fundraising, there's always pressure. You need to close the round and, you know, it's tricky and hard to convince someone very quickly to, without knowing before, to invest, you know, millions or tens of millions in your business, right? Now, if you speak to investors when you're not raising and start building the relationship, they will see how you're progressing. And by the time you actually need to raise another round of capital, you have established a trust. And also they will have seen you working and developing your company and et cetera for a while. So yeah, those all things are important. And, you know, just one versus the other, you know, it's tricky. I think the more you combine all of these and make, you know, and bring investors on board along with you as early as possible, the better.
Yes, I was definitely going to ask if there was any advice for other founders looking to raise capital. It sounds like, you know, building those relationships with investors and, you know, before you envision that you're even going to need the capital is super important. Anything else or any other nuggets of wisdom that could be good for any other founders out there?
Look, obviously, at the moment, the market is different from it was. So trying to build a business that requires less capital is potentially a good way to go, which is definitely, you know, easier said than done. You know, that's absolutely true. But what that means is being maybe a lot more, you know, focused on things like unit economics, like retention, like, you know, you sign up a customer, do they stay with you? Do they pay you more than it costs you to service the customer, right? This is the kind of stuff that investors are now putting a lot more focus on than maybe, you know, 2-3 years ago, when the main metric or the main thing was how fast is this business growing, regardless of sometimes the underlying unit economics or complexity there. Now, you know, this have shifted a lot of focus to, okay, is the business model solid? Is there demand for the service? You know, what we are seeing is less important now to show extreme fast growth on the top line versus, you know, showing sustainable growth in a way that could lead to profitability soon. And those are the trade-offs. Sometimes you can just accelerate growth by inflating or investing a lot more, let's say, in marketing expense. But when you reduce the marketing budget, then all that growth falls off a cliff. And that is not a sustainable business potentially, right? So these are the kind of stuff that is important. And again, back to the pitch deck question, it's important to show those details in the deck and obviously explain with the numbers. And, you know, the more proven those assumptions are, the better. Obviously, it depends when you're raising a seed or a series A, or, you know, depends on what stage the business is, you know, how much data you'd have. But, you know, the more and the earlier you can actually prove these things, show concrete data, track record, and on those unit economic levels, the better.
Great. Yeah, and thanks for that. Definitely some great insights. And looking to the future, in a perfect world, what does student finance look like in 10 years' time?
So in 10 years' time, obviously it's a long time, but, you know, we would be, you know, supporting millions of people and, you know, upskilling, reskilling. The topic of shortage of talent or skills should have disappeared by improving efficiencies and building and enabling the infrastructure to enable everyone to access the skills they need when they need them, and removing all sort of friction and barriers from the process, which, you know, I think what we are proud of this is also something that, from the impact side, we're making a huge impact on individual people in their lives, but also in society, right? So obviously, you know, getting people the right skills for jobs means that they can progress economically, they can get better jobs, they can support their families. But that also means economies can thrive, companies can grow better. So that's the role we play, and we want to keep making a huge impact on that side.
Amazing. Well, yeah, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. It's great to hear more about you and student finance and that fundraising process. Is there anything that we haven't spoken about today that you'd like to highlight, or places where people can go to connect with you or hear more about student finance?
I'm on LinkedIn. I think it's an easy way to find me and reach out to me. I think from anyone looking to start a business, probably now is an amazing time. So, you know, you talked a lot about the market not being amazing from fundraising and all of that, but, you know, often, and this is for learnings from previous crises, is that in the toughest times is when the best businesses emerge, when the most opportunities are created. So, you know, I think it's definitely a good time for anyone that thinks of starting something, you know, just go for it and make that first move, first step, and then you will definitely not regret it.
Amazing. Well, yeah, thanks so much, Mariano. I really appreciate you joining us today. This was great.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.